Okay, Coast Noise Podcast number 19, just done recording with Chris Gillespie. And we talked a lot of cool stuff. We talked about some films, closing out the best and worst of this year in films. We also talked about, he tells us, with his experience at the Sundance Festivals and the SMF Festival. He talks a little bit about some stand-up comedy stuff in Phoenix, Arizona, and San Diego, some places that he's lived. You know, we talk about good screenwriters, good directors, what makes good movies in general, horror, and all kinds of different stuff. We talk the Dark Tower series and some good video games that came out this year at the very end. So that's what we got for you today. If you want to hear more, you can go to coastalnoise.com. You can go to the podcast page. You can download the audio file to your MP3 player, your smartphone, or your computer, or you can listen straight off the webpage on our audio player. There's also the blog section where I've got a new article on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I've got an even newer one that's coming out soon, hopefully, about some surfing spots in America. And I'm thinking about going couch surfing over the summer and just finding the best place and all that. I'll explain later on. It's still in the works. There's a music page if you want to go check out some stuff that I've put up. I'm about to take down the track Native Blues, which was like an improv song that I did while I was detuning my guitar to restring it one night and just kind of started fooling around. So if you want to check that out, I might be pulling that soon. Also, if you want to have a listen to Keep Me Out of Touch, is one of my newest things that I've put up that I recorded, and I really like that one. What can I say? I did okay with it, you know what I mean? So besides all that, what else we got for you? Maybe go into the grocery this Thursday night to do some open mic stuff, maybe with Daniel Cavanaugh, Ryan Vine, Skyver, myself, and I think Chris is also going to join us there as well. So if you want to come out, have a good time, have some laughs, we'll be there. The front page, we got the contact section if you want to get in touch with the Coastal Noise peoples. There's also social media, Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff. If you want to support the show, you can always just go and like whatever it is that's whatever's Coastal Noise related. And of course, that helps us out. And it costs you nothing. And it's your way of saying, hey, then that was pretty good there. So there you go. And I think that's all. We'll just go ahead and ride into it. Coastal Noise Podcast number 19, Chris Gillespie. Here it is. Y'all are both staring at something.
I'm zigging at the grass.
Y'all are all about the grass, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of grass, how about them movies out there today?
The movies today.
Yeah, the movies today. Let me tell you what. They're pretty awesome. So, today, New Year's Eve day. We're about to start 2014. So, Chris, since you're a film major at Arizona State, I figured we could talk a lot about a recap, a year of 2013, of what's been good and what's been so-so. And to be honest, I don't even care if it's been this year that it came out, because I catch up on a lot of movies that are older, and if it's good, then I'm like, yeah, that's one of the best movies I've seen this year. So, what have you seen lately that was good stuff?
You know, honestly, this year I've been watching a lot of the older movies, so I haven't actually gotten a chance to see any of the new things. I know I've wanted to see Ender's Game. It was a book that I read as a kid. I haven't been able to see it yet, though. I saw the new Star Trek. Pretty good, except I have always been a fan of the Patrick Stewart, the Next Generation series, Star Trek.
Was that Into Darkness?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that too. I think the first one was a little bit better.
Yeah, I don't like with the first one how they kind of changed the path of the whole series with the whole time, which I always felt that like time travel and like science fiction has always been like a writer's
Hold
block
on a second.
Answer.
What's up? You need to move my car.
Yeah.
Okay. There.
Like, I always felt like every time a comic book's written and they start introducing time travel, it's because they ran out of ideas, and this is a way to... Kind of like when a sitcom introduces forgotten family members. The same way. It's like, oh, this means that we're on our way out of being able to come up with creative ideas.
Yeah.
So I didn't like that aspect of it.
I saw the Conjuring the other day. Did you ever catch that one?
No, I haven't seen that. But is it a found film, or is it just a plain old horror?
Because I would say it's plain old horror.
I noticed a recent trend in horror films where they're beginning to go back to using like orchestrated music for the tones. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you watch Insidious, it's no longer this like techno thing that we've been getting used to.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, they've gone back to the Hitchcock style of like having really dramatic orchestrated music.
Yeah, it's a good move in my book.
Yeah,
Insidious was probably, I don't know if I saw it this, I think it was this year for the first time that I saw it. And I mean, that's been one of my favorite scary movies. I've seen it twice now, and that is
it's pretty good.
Really good scary movie.
Although I don't like, there's always an aspect that I don't like, and it's that Darth Maul is the bad guy. I didn't really understand that aspect.
Oh, yeah. Good observation there.
But if you couple it with the girl bad guy, or the female, witch at the end, I don't know what that was. That was kind of a scary bad guy.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool how they hypnotize the dad to go in after the brother, or the son, rather.
Yeah.
And they go into that, he goes into that other underworld kind of thing, and it's a very dream state. I mean, the way they bring him into that is just really great.
Yeah, and who was that actress that played the medium? She reminded me of the old lady that used to play in those Poltergeist movies, a little short old lady that was kind of creepy. They had the voice like this. I don't know if you remember that.
Was she she wasn't the lady who hypnotized him, was she?
In Insidious, there's a woman that hypnotizes him.
Oh, okay.
She was kind of creepy sounding and looking, but it's the good guy. And the same thing in the Poltergeist, there was a character that was like a medium, and she was like kind of creepy, but like the good guy, like the helper, I guess.
See, I've heard of that one, but I haven't seen it, the Poltergeist.
Right, there's like a whole, there's several of those movies actually that are made in the 80s.
Okay.
I remember as a kid, those are the thing. Those movies are the ones that scared me the most. That and the Hellraiser series from Clive Barker.
Okay, yeah, I haven't seen those either.
I always was more scared as a kid by the supernatural movies, like demonic possessions, like Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Than anything else.
Recently watched The Exorcist again, and it's still got some scary parts, but it like doesn't quite hold up, I guess. But this movie, The Conjuring. I mean, it was really scary because it was shot on like a $20 million budget, which is relatively low for a film. And
it's not bad, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's usually with a horror movie. It depends on what the studio was, but I mean, a lot of the Michael Bay films are budgeted at $200 million.
Yeah, I should say that this film did have like a lot of special effects, a lot of cool scenes that did have some really crazy stuff going on.
Right.
I don't know
because you gotta
how
imagine,
that correlates
like,
with the budget, but it was still pretty impressive. And just the way it's shot, I mean, it looks like it's a 1970s movie, which to me is pretty awesome because it already looks like it's an aged movie. You know, for anybody that you show this movie to like 5 or 10 years down the road, they're going to think it came from the 80s or something like that. But it's really cool. And the way it's just the way the film is shot, not just the quality of the film, but their panning, their movement, and all these kinds of things. It looks like it's very conservative in ways. But I like that. I thought that was really interesting.
As a frame of reference, you compare that to the Blair Witch Project, which was the first found film, and it was budgeted at about $30,000 is what they spent on it, and it grossed about $20 million in the first week.
Wow.
Roughly. And that's something that's a very brilliant idea. That's probably the smartest horror movie I've ever seen come out. Not because I personally like it, but in terms of how much money it made versus, and also the fact that it started a new generation of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was like one of the smartest ways to make a movie. Just have an extremely low budget on purpose and still make, you know, millions because you're making it realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't seen that one either. But I mean, did that movie come from a well-established director already? Like, how did it take off so well?
It was independent.
Like,
it was actually a Sundance film, and then it got made into another a bigger film. I don't know how much you know about the Sundance Festival. It was started by Robert Redford, excuse me, sorry, I had to think of that for a minute. It was started by Robert Redford to be able to find like more directors that can, you know, that are more artistic than the majors that were already in the studios. And basically, every year when they have the Sundance, they usually pick one film, or they like representatives from the different studios will pick up one film from it, and you make it into a movie. And it's usually the ones that do that is because Fox is the studio, but you know how they have Fox Searchlight? Well, it's like that. The Searchlight is the one that goes out to these different film festivals and finds new talent. And I think most of the studios have like a subsidiary company that goes out and does that. And you've seen them like in like before. I know Fox Searchlight's what found Slumdog Millionaire, which is what put Bollywood on the map for American film as a competitor.
Robert Redford. I recognize the name, but...
The original Great Gatsby. He was Gatsby. Not the Leonardo DiCaprio version, but the like 50s or 60s version.
I haven't seen either, actually.
He was considered like the Brad Pitt of the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Like that kind of actor.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I would love to go to those like Sundance festivals. And I know there's some other ones.
CMF is the one that I did last year.
CMF.
Yeah, although I had my crew kind of fell apart. I wrote the screenplay. I started the production or the pre-production. I got all the equipment ready, and all the people that I had already cast like bailed out on me, except for like two. And by that time, it wasn't enough because the way the CMF festival works is they give you a week. They give you a GoPro and a bunch of equipment, including software, and they give you a week to make a 5-minute film, and it can't be anywhere over that. And they just want to see what you can come up with, and you can't use any copyrighted material. I had the screenplay written out. I already figured out what music I wanted to use because I had a friend of mine that's a musician. So I could, I mean, obviously get, it's not copyrighted. It's, you know, him letting me use it. And then everybody else kind of fell apart on that.
What was the premise?
Oh, it's still on my computer actually, but it's, just a, my mother died over the, summer, and, I wrote a screenplay kind of about her life, like, almost like a biography.
And what is the award for winning, you know, at that festival?
Well, you get to go to Hollywood and meet some major directors. Like, I think this year they advertised Robert Rodriguez being there. It's more of a networking opportunity, but it's like all expense paid trip to Hollywood to meet, you know, and network with like major producers and directors. So it's definitely a good experience or a good thing to put on a resume if you're looking to work like I am.
So when did you first get interested in film? I mean, has it been a thing since you were a kid?
Well, it started with my main goal being a comedian or like working in stand-up. I thought that a film is the best way to supplement that. For instance, I have a lot of screenwriting courses next semester, and I'm going to be supplementing that with my comedy writing, mostly writing comedies. ASU also has a sketch comedy group that I'll be working with this year. Called Bear in Mind Sketch Comedy.
And so comedy was the original thing for you?
Yeah, comedy is the original.
So when did that, I mean, was that when you were a kid, or was it more of when you were a teenager? How were you exposed to it?
I don't know if anybody ever, like, as a kid goes, I want to be a stand-up comedian. I mean, maybe there are those people out there. I think it just started just because I've always wanted to entertain. I mean, everybody that knew me in high school knew that I was like a class clown. And then it kind of continued into the Marine Corps when I enlisted. And I just was always the one that tried to keep the upbeat, you know, positive vibes going with, you know, laughter. I've always felt that laughter was one of the most important things. And it's something that can take someone that's going through the worst time and make them not feel that way, even if it's only for a moment. You know, it's something that I think is really powerful, and that's kind of what drew me to it. And then, you know, I've like heard a lot of people, like, man, you should be a comedian. And then you get that in your head enough, and you just start doing it. So I started out in San Diego, actually, when I lived there. And then I moved to Arizona after I exited the military.
And were you doing, what was your level of experience in San Diego? Were you just warming up to the stage, just doing open mics?
It was actually one night I was at this bar called Moondoggies with a few buddies of mine, and it's one of those open mics where they just kind of let anybody go up, and you just sign up when you get there, or whenever, kind of like they do like a karaoke night the same way.
Right.
So I was kind of drunk, and I went up there and made an ass of myself, got back down, had no experience, And then I started actually wanting to do it because people thought I was funny, more laughing at me because I was, you know, really drunk. But I started actually writing down ideas, and it eventually just evolved into like an actual set. It started with, I would tell stories, but I've learned by experience, you don't usually want to tell stories in like a 5 or 10 minute, you know, stand up, like featured or open mic, because at that point you have a problem with, you want as many laughs per 5 minute as you can get. And it ends up becoming like math. Like, you don't, like, stories have like way too much buildup. Like, you don't want like 20 minutes of buildup unless you have like a lot of different taglines to follow the punchline,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that, because it just gets like overwhelming. And then when you're only getting 3 laughs in 5 minutes, I mean, you really can't consider that too successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People will laugh and they don't hate you, but it's not like they're going to remember you.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's also about, you know, a lot of comedians look at it as how much laughter can I get in a certain amount of time.
Right.
But also try to think of it as how entertaining can you be? So right. Like, even if you don't get laughs, but if the people are super engaged with what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting, it draws them in, then I mean,
right.
I don't see any problem with that either. But with a 5 minute set, cause I do know of like people who do only allow for 5 minute sets, you know, and I mean, that's especially, true for
the standard with pretty much most, open mics.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
The only difference for me has been like ASU comedy. When I perform like on campus, they'll have like I have a little bit more time there because then I'm actually a featured comedian.
Yeah, 10 minutes is really the way to go if you can allow it in an open mic, because then that gives you for like a 5 minute story and then a couple quick, you know, one liners mm-hmm. or just short jokes and stuff.
Usually,
like
I
that.
Would end if you're going to do it that way. You would end with the story. I think that's the way to do it. And, you know, tell the audience you're going to end with this, and then there's a story, and
mm-hmm.
thank the audience for coming.
Mm-hmm. So now you do that quite a bit in Phoenix, Arizona, right?
Different bars in the Phoenix area.
Uh-huh. And so what's the scene like in Phoenix?
It's really funny. There seems to be, as far as the fans or the bars, there's actually a lot of bars. I've actually been able to go online and figure out an entire week of comedy where if I wanted to perform every night of the week, I could,
mm-hmm.
because I'm thinking that the comedy clubs around the Phoenix area kind of work with each other to figure out, you know, that way there's not like a double up on nights. But it depends on where you go. I mean, the Tempe Improv is where I'll be performing February 6th with ASU comedy. They're more like you have to like call them in advance, kind of like you would do like with a magic show or like a play or something. It's not like you just go there every Thursday and perform. But then you got other places like Copper Blues, and you look at it and it's like a bar, and the stage is actually right behind the beer taps. And you think that's like kind of like one of the lower ends, but I've opened up for Owen Benjamin there. So it's not like people still like people. If you ask like the more famous comedians, they think that one of the funnest towns to perform in is Phoenix. That's why one of Louis C.K.'s DVD specials is in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenix, and I hear a lot of Seattle and like the Portland area, well, Portland, Oregon rather, but Portland and Seattle mm-hmm. are two cities that are like well known for having like comedians like to go there to perform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm hearing a lot for Denver too. A lot of people seem to like Denver.
But as far as the comedians, to finish your question, as far as the comedians, I seem to every time I perform, I see the same faces that are performing with me, and it seems like there's this weird kind of competition where nobody likes to laugh at the other person that's like performing, and it's like a challenge almost, like make the other comedians laugh, because if I do that, that means it was a genuine laughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Now, are you doing this for free, or I mean, are you a paid?
No, I'm not paid at all.
Yeah, so you're just trying to work your way in, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I've also learned like some of the dirtier aspects of the comedy scene in Phoenix. Just one of the club owners is kind of just dirty with the way he handles his club. And I'm not going to get into too many specifics about that, but it just kind of like opened my eyes to like, wow, this is all that, you know, rock and roll business I was like always told about.
Mm-hmm.
Not really.
So you plan to keep doing that, and your goal is to break in the scene and just be kind of a regular guy in it. You know, you do want to get paid for sure, right?
I don't like getting involved in the drama with the other comedians. It seems like some of the female comedians have dated, like they only date comedians, and it seems like there's like a lot of drama between them, and like they won't perform at the same like shows. You know, it just seems like I don't know. It seems to be really awkward when I see that happen all the time. So I don't really get involved with any of the other comedians unless, you know, it's professional. Like I worked on a film with a friend of mine named Noah Findling. He's a good guy. He's a comedian, and he you know, wrote a film that I worked with for a little bit.
What why screenwriting over the production aspect of film? Do you just enjoy writing so much that it just seemed kind of natural to progress in that direction?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I remember my first major in college before I ever enlisted was English. But I think the main thing is that like I want to be able to have a formulated structure for writing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like being a film, you know, Woody Allen was a stand-up comedian before he was a producer. So I feel like I'm just trying to be very versatile with what I want to do. I know what I want to do, but there's so much in that spectrum of like comedy that you can do, you know, whether it be stand up or film, you know, like whether it be producing, acting or directing. And I want to be able to get all the experience. I think it's always been good to be like a jack of all trades. And then you can kind of work from there to figure out what specifically you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to do. Because I'm also going to try to join the improv group next year next semester at ASU, just to get even more like different like faceted experiences with it.
So, in your opinion, who are some of the best screenwriters out there?
The Coen brothers. They write pretty good films. Frank Coppola. The guy that wrote The Godfather.
Okay.
But you know what? It's really hard to say like screenwriter. Because you see movies, and oftentimes it ends up being just based off of a book, and you don't really know who to get credit to. You know, like Apocalypse Now. I mean, that's actually just an adaptation, like a Vietnam adaptation of the Joseph Conrad book, Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
So who do you really give credit to, Joseph Conrad or I think it was Coppola also, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That did Apocalypse Now.
Well, they seem to take themes and elements of it, what they do with that movie in itself, the Vietnam aspect of it. I mean, I think that's enough to definitely give credit. I mean, as respected as it is as a movie and as a script nowadays, I mean, that's one of those ones where, yeah, Heart of Darkness, you know, it's based kind of loosely off of it. But I think you would definitely have to give credit to those guys for sure.
Yeah.
For the writers of it.
I think the most powerful that, and I know this is, I got to do a paper on this. The most powerful like movie I've ever seen in terms of the screenwriting, and I know it was purely her, it was Kimberly Pierce, who wrote and directed the movie Boys Don't Cry. It was the movie with it was filmed in 1999. It was a Hilary Swank, and basically it was about a transgender male named Brandon Tina that basically wanted to be a boy and fell in love with a girl in like a backwards town and got murdered for it, raped and murdered. And I mean, I'm giving a very, very brief summary of the movie, but it was just the way you can imagine the way that it was filmed was really powerful. And it was based off of a true story. So it was just really heart-wrenching. I remember like just bawling for 20 minutes after watching that.
Really?
Yeah. Really good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely hard to find that in movies, and that's what makes, you know, some of the best movies the best, is like the level of emotion that they can get out of a person.
Right.
That's what was one thing that was really special to me with The Conjuring, because it really gave me that. I watched it by myself, and it really gave me that feeling of like, I don't want to watch what's about to happen next. And that rarely happens for me with scary movies, because scary movies are usually like super cheesy, unrealistic, terrible acting,
right,
poorly written, bad effects. Yeah. All these things. I mean, it's really hard to make a good scary movie, but if you can pull it off, you're up there with, you know, The Thing and The Shining and The Exorcist and Aliens and all those other things that really, really lean on suspense buildup and appropriate execution,
right,
of that moment that make, like, there's a scene in The Conjuring where, the ladies, there's a wife who's, her daughter's telling her that she has this toy that winds up with a music box and it's got a mirror and it spins. And she says that she has this imaginary friend. And if you look in it at the end of the music, you'll be able to see him in the mirror. And she's looking at it and she sees it spinning and the camera kind of pans in closer. And then she kind of like looks at it a little bit and you think you see something. and then the music stops and it's like real close and she's staring at it. And it'll go, boo, and she jumps her up right behind the mom. Yeah. And she goes, I got you, mommy. So
that nice little foreshadowing for like the, it's almost like they build up. All right, this is the type of thrill you're going to get for the rest of this movie. We're just giving you a little practice run.
Yeah.
I like it when they do that in movies. And then I always can expect it too, like in a horror movie, like the first scare is usually like not going to be a real thing.
Mm-hmm. And there's like, this creepy doll that's in the movie at some parts just all kinds of stuff. I don't want to ruin a lot of it, but I mean, it's from start to finish, it's a fantastic film. It is spot on. And one of the best, definitely one of the best of this year, I'd say. What about you with scary movies? I mean, because like I said, they're hard to pick.
Well, I'll tell you my formula for like any movie, and it applies to scary movies. I like anything that goes past the Hollywood, like standard Hollywood structure of movies. Mm-hmm. And this is why I don't like a lot of the superhero movies that are based on comic books, save for the Dark Knight series that Christopher Nolan's made. It seems like Hollywood with action and scary movies always has like the similar, like with the genre, they have the same plot that they don't ever try to change. Like, it's almost like Tom Clancy's books. Like, all it is the same like formula and the way the plot like escalates, but just with different characters and like a different genre.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually like a hero who's like kind of unexpected to be a hero, usually like a weak person, maybe a girl or like a sickly boy or something, or like an unpopular kid.
Yeah.
And then it escalates from there where they end up being the hero and they have to overcome their own personal fears, and then they can defeat whatever the enemy is.
Right.
It seems to be the case in every movie. Even the most popular movie this year, The Avengers, you know, all the characters come together and they have to battle out, you know, all the differences they have. And then, like, there's, like, a low point in the movie, and then they overcome it, and then, like, triumph in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that as much because it's just overdone, you know? If I would have seen just that in terms of the way it's been written, I probably would have enjoyed it. But that's the way that American filmmakers always write movies, mm-hmm. especially with the major studios. But the things that really stick out to me I'll get back to this, Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock designed his own formula for writing scary movies. And it was when you watch like movies like Psycho, the aspect was instead of taking the perspective of the victim, have the audience take the perspective of the killer. And that's what scared people about those movies so much back then, was the fact that people felt uncomfortable about being in the seat of the killer instead of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
As a victim, it's like justified. But the killer, you know, it's like, oh, I don't like that, because this formula so far up until then was to scare people by making a situation as close to being real as the, you know, viewer could imagine, but not actually being real. And that's like how you get fear and enjoyment out of the movie. And that's the way Hitchcock saw it. But he decided to change it up and put people in this uncomfortable position. And I thought that was like things like that. Like when people are able to adapt new routines, that's what always sticks out in my head when I watch a film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because victims in scary movies are usually very expendable, it's hard to make a connection with them. There's not a lot of depth to them because they're going to be right. gone in no time. Whereas if you have a great villain on hand, to get the audience to know that villain, to really understand it and be close all the time, people don't like that that proximity level to it. Just like with The Silence of the Lambs, when you have Hannibal Lecter, there's a lot of scenes where, you know, he's very close talking to Clarice and you really get to see his mind work and get his backstory and all these things, and then his escape scene and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that's why he's one of the best. And then if you look at No Country for Old Men, it's not a scary movie, but the villain's one of the best in you know, of all time, in my opinion. Anton Chigurh.
People like to follow the villain more than they do the hero, and people forget that, but I think Hitchcock caught on to that and was able to adapt.
Because,
I mean, Psycho is one of the, like, it's what turned Hollywood on its side in terms of, like, scary movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I think it's Alfred Hitchcock that I recently tried to get into some of his films, because I don't know if I've seen a single one. And I went to Blockbuster to ask, and they didn't have them. And then I just found out recently that all Blockbusters are like now out of business.
Yeah.
They're pretty much closed at this point.
Yeah, it's the way the exhibition game works.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy,
though.
Once
people started getting Netflix and Hulu and Redbox, you didn't need Blockbuster anymore.
Yeah, which is kind of weird, because now you have to seek out I mean, it. When you go to Blockbuster, you get to walk in, you see everything, you get a physical experience of picking up an item. You can talk to people who are movie fans there most of the time. Some of them are there just to hit buttons. But, I mean, like, but sometimes you run into people who are really, you know, interested in movies, and that's why they're there. And, like, I found this one movie called Daywatch that this guy pointed out to me because I was just looking for something, and I saw Quentin Tarantino make a remark about it. And it's like a Russian fantasy thriller kind of thing, and it has a lot of elements that are like special effects that kind of look similar to The Matrix, and it was an interesting film, weird but interesting. So when you lose all that, you know, and you're just sitting at your home and you're just on the couch and you're just like flipping through, you're not flipping boxes, you're just looking at pictures on your TV, and you know, you're just picking things based off that. And I mean, I don't know. It's going to work out, because I mean, I've been using Netflix and online renting and all this kind of stuff for a couple of years now, so I know where it's going to go, and it's going to work out, and it's going to be fine. But at the same time, it kind of sucks that the intimate relationship of going to a movie store to go
or
in
a theater,
yeah, and a theater, yeah,
that's
for sure,
dying too.
You think so?
Well, let's look at the perspective of people over time. When we were kids, we had VHS, so it wasn't really a big deal going to the movies. But think about in the 1950s when people were going to the movies. When you went to that, that was the only time you were going to be able to see that movie for that like 2 week or 3 week period that it was at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
After that, you had to just wait, and maybe it'll be on like a TV channel. But let's look before TV. Like, you went to a movie, like one of the great movie palaces that D.W. Griffith started. You went to the movie palace to watch a movie, and that was the last time you're ever going to see that movie. And then TV came out, and then that got a little bit better, because like some, like the three channels you could get would, like ABC would sometimes like have a follow or a rerun. But, and then now you got VHS and DVD. It's not as special anymore. You know, people used to, that's why you hear old people talk about like a movie that they saw in like 1939. So because that's the only time they ever would have expected to see that movie. So it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just slowly dying. It's been getting killed more and more every year. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why it's just a really interesting time to be a part of the film industry, is because now the like YouTube and these different online exhibitionists are like coming into play. We're starting to see a shift in the way that people are exhibiting movies, because the three main aspects you need in order to have like a vertically integrated studio is the production aspect, the distribution, and the exhibition. And if you have all three, which YouTube and Netflix and those places have the distribution and exhibition, all they need is a production. If you have all three, I mean, you're a vertically integrated company or studio. So I think that we might, unless they're able to adapt, we might start seeing a downfall of some of these major studios like Fox and Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I'm just hoping it doesn't turn into a thing like the music industry. Like, the internet came, people started ripping music everywhere, people stopped buying CDs, and
sure,
also digital media made it so easy for anybody to just get a laptop and record their band, their garage band, and all this stuff. And I mean, it was kind of cool in a lot of ways, but at the same time, you had an introduction of all these terrible musicians, people who have no business picking up any kind of instrument, and
yeah,
just singing into, you know, low quality equipment and all this stuff. I mean, you find a lot of people that may have not had a means to become recognized, but then you have, for every one, you have 100 other terrible people who are just diluting the entire industry and
yeah,
making it hard for everyone else to find
the
gems.
I think the internet revealed the world for what it really was to people.
Oh yeah.
Before that, we kind of didn't really know what people did behind doors, and now we do.
Right.
It made us more knowledgeable, but it's like, it's kind of sad.
Yeah.
This is how we really are.
Yeah.
But now we're just used to it, and it's definitely interesting how we're not. It's like, it's one thing that we thought that we were starting to become a private society, but really the internet flipped that on its side. We aren't becoming private, because even within our doors, we can see what goes on outside of our house.
Yeah. And I mean, I would like to think, though, that it makes it maybe not easier, but more rewarding and easier to connect to the people that we most relate to, people that we would most likely get along with. And so, you know, therefore, I mean, it has its ups and downs for sure. But as far as film goes with it, I don't know. Do you really think, so let's see, let's just analyze it. Why do you go to a theater? Okay. Well, it's because the movies are there first, so you can charge more for premium viewing. So you've got the early, the fact that the movies are there earlier. You've got the fact that the screen and the sound quality, what you get to view the movie on. That, and when you said, you know, that's dying, that was the first thing that came into my mind is like, well, do you really think that people are going to give up that quality of viewing? But then again, I mean, we got to look at our TVs. I mean, there's a 50-inch TV right over there, and every year it gets bigger, better, cheaper. So,
yeah,
you know,
what's
and
end up
projectors
happening?
Are getting big again, and they're good quality projectors. So, you know, and sound systems are in the same ballpark.
What I think is going to happen is that eventually, with the distribution and exhibition already being handled by the internet, eventually a website or an app or something is going to offer the studios more money than the theaters can give them, and they're going to go to them first to exhibit their movies first, and that's what's going to happen. Because, you said it for me, TVs are getting bigger with better graphics and better sound systems for cheaper. So eventually people are just going to want to do it at home and have, like, even if it's like inviting a bunch of friends over, you're not really getting rid of that experience. Now you're just making it with people that you only like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't usually like to have movie nights alone. I mean, there are people like me that like to watch films, but a lot of times people do like to watch movies with people. And I think that's what's going to happen is the internet, like a website is going to eventually offer enough money to a major studio and like that exceeds what like a theater chain can give them. And that's how they're going to release their movies. And I would even say, you know, it'll be like a 2-week period on this website and then you got to get it from somewhere else or buy it like an iTunes buy. I mean, I buy my music on iTunes and that's already what people are doing. Like, I don't know the last time I've been to a record store because I can just buy whatever album I want from my pocket,
mm-hmm.
you know, right when I want it.
Yeah. It's weird. We actually don't have any record stores here.
Yeah.
We have one. Maynard's Music in Ocean Springs, and they do vinyls and CDs and all this stuff. But that's it. I mean, as far as I know, there's nobody else. And, you know, when I was in Hattiesburg, living in Hattiesburg for a while, there was T-Bones Records, and they're a fantastic store. And I mean, they do live music. They have a nice little coffee shop with some food. You know, you can listen to the music. They have videos, all this stuff. Awesome deal. And you know, it was really cool just to be able to call them up and be like, hey, I want the new Queens of the Stone Age album when it comes out. I want the new Black Keys album or whatever. They'd get it in, you know, you'd get it reserved, you'd get it in, and they'd call you, you know, on your phone, and like an actual human would tell you, hey, we got your CD in, and you go down there and pick it up and all this stuff. So once again, it kind of sucks that that's not there, because I'd rather have the CD. I feel like, first of all, the CD is better quality, like in your car and all this stuff. Like the compression on the MP3s are just like really muffled and just not as crisp and clear. So I don't know if vinyls are better than CD. That's probably debatable.
That's what everybody's been saying.
I mean, I have a vinyl player. I have old records. I have new records. And they sound really good. I'm not going to argue that. But they're not very practical either.
See, I think that most people in America value convenience over quality, though. And I think that's why... I'm not saying that I will prefer watching a movie on my own in my house with, you know, my friends.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying I would prefer that over going to a theater.
Right.
But I'm just saying that it's going to be cheaper and more convenient.
Yeah. And I think quality follows convenience. So maybe we'll get... You know, we definitely will get the best of both worlds eventually.
Right.
It's just it always sucks in the beginning, mm-hmm. when the transition has taken place. Because they're going to meet the demands of the majority, and the majority of people want convenience first. Mm-hmm. You know, give me, because a lot of people aren't very into the finer aspects of what it is. But after that, people come along and they cater to that audience. That audience pays top dollar. Then from the sales of it being paid to from those people and from the prices that it cost, then it levels out the market, makes it more affordable for that. Even the regular people who didn't even care about quality can now have quality just because quality's there and it's at a price that they're willing to do, you know.
Right.
It's just like the next step. So I don't know if we're there with music that yet.
I feel like the music industry kind of follows the film industry, even culturally. You know, when you had Beach Boingo come out in the 50s, that's when you started having all these like fun time, summertime, you know, Beach Boys and like bands like that come out.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like, you know, music does definitely follow the cultural trends, and I would think that they also follow the production trends to be able to stay on top.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, what I was talking about, things being diluted, whether in movies or in music, when I have, like, I have a music subscription on my phone, and it's like $10, and I get whatever music that they provide, and they provide a lot with no ads for like $10 a month. And I can, it's just on my phone. My phone's with me everywhere. I can plug it in my car, put it in headphones, whatever. And I find a lot of great music through it that way. The quality is decent. And it costs less than like a single CD. CDs are usually like $10 to $13, usually about $13. So I have that aspect. But I find myself less likely to pull out my phone, like when I'm in my car, and like search for a specific album that I want to listen to and just listen to it all the way through. Because when I get in my car, I'm so used to the CD days that I go, what do I want to hear? And then it becomes, well, what do I have? And I go to my CD case and I see what I have. And I physically put it in and et cetera. And I'm focused, you know, on that one album and all the works of that one album as the artist created it, as it was intended for the listener to hear. For me, the MP3 or the phone doesn't happen as much because there's so much on it, and I just don't, there's nothing physical about it and all these kinds of things, so it dilutes it for me, and I end up listening to a bunch of stuff that I'm just listening to, whereas instead of appreciating one particular thing, you know what I mean?
I think, well, do you ever buy music from iTunes?
Rarely. Maybe once every six months.
That's what I do. I have about 2,000 songs on it. And first of all, I do that because as an artist, I feel that I wouldn't want people ripping off anything that I work on. So I don't want to do it to other, you know, people that are performing.
Yeah.
And so I always buy music, or at least watch it on YouTube, where like YouTube's paying certain royalties for having, you know, their music for official
mm-hmm.
videos.
Mm-hmm.
But iTunes also has, because of the fact that it was made the way they have, you know, contracts with these artists, they have the ability to get the actual song as the way the artist wanted you to hear it as well. For instance, Tool won't put out like just one song. You can't just buy one song from them because they want you to buy the full album because their albums are like concept albums.
Right.
Like to them, you have to listen to the whole thing to get like their message.
Right.
And as a result, you can't just buy single songs from iTunes for Tool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the iTunes is the answer to being able to buy music conveniently and like listen to it the way that the artist intended you to listen to it, because that's the way it was made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of like the meeting of the best of both worlds. But for some reason, for a lot of people, and you're not the only one, people don't really buy from iTunes anymore, like at all. And if they do, it's just like I'll look at people's iPods or iPhones maybe, and they'll have like a song or two
mm-hmm.
Just from when maybe they're on a road trip and they wanted to listen to a song or something.
Right.
But that's really all I ever see.
Yeah. Which ends up making more artists, music artists who are trying to make albums that just have a bunch of like hit songs mm-hmm. because they know singular downloads are what's hot.
Yeah.
And that results in a couple, 3 or 4 good ones, and then a lot of just crappy songs,
yeah.
which is a bummer. And then you go through iPods, people who are that way, and you go through their iPods, and they have what I call tourist iPods.
Yeah,
it's just a bunch of artists, and you go, finally, you're searching through, and you're like, oh, finally, a good artist, and you click on it, and it's like
one or two
songs, you know.
That's song you've heard a million too, times. I've recently been more buying the album.
Yeah.
So I got a lot of actual albums on my iTunes.
Yeah. And I still want to do that. I still want to purchase like whole albums and things like that. But like it's hard to find it. You know, I end up going to like Amazon. But then that also feels like a cop-out in a way too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is or not, but I feel like the artists probably aren't getting as much because Amazon, I don't know.
Right.
You know, I really don't know. It just feels like Amazon is like the major shipper and distributor of music. It's like I'm buying from them now, whereas before I might have been paying on iTunes, which was also the biggest distributor and all this stuff. So, you know, it's just this very weird thing. It's like I would love to just walk into the store, find someone who knows about music, deals with music, and it's like, here's what it is. Well, this is what I want.
I think the film industry is going through the same thing. I mean, people, you know, go into the theater and record, and it's always, it's maybe a bad copy, but people are still willing to steal it from it.
Yeah.
You know, the host. So I think that once we start getting rid of theater chains, and I mean, you know, I know that it may cost jobs, but that's the way that the world works.
Mm-hmm.
Once we start like seeing the theater chain die out, you're not going to see as much piracy.
Yeah.
The only way you're going to be able to get it eventually is by buying it from iTunes or Amazon or something like that.
Yeah. I was thinking about 3D printers. I wonder if that'll change the game a little bit. Like, what if you could just buy an album and then it would print out the whole work as it is right there? I mean, that would be kind of...
I don't know if it's as intricate as that. I know I was watching a thing the other day about how they're trying to make guns on 3D printers, and they can't... They can do everything but, like, make the barrel. Mm-hmm. You still need, like, a barrel to do it.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. I've been hearing more and more about those things more...
Yeah.
More often. I don't know how many times I said more in that sentence, but whatever. But, I mean, if it really develops into what the sci-fi idea of it could be, who knows? Could be a film on your hand right there.
You remember those commercials where it's like, you wouldn't download a pizza, like talking about piracy?
Oh, yeah.
I always remember thinking, well, I would if it was possible, and now maybe it is possible.
Yeah.
Maybe you can put like pizza in a 3D printer, and it just, boop, makes you something out of nothing.
That would be pretty great. I don't know if people running around with tons of guns in the streets with just homemade guns that don't work that great all the time. I don't know if that would be the best thing ever, but
yeah, it was on a History Channel thing that I had watched.
So we were talking about the best and worst of this year. Can you think of any of either of in those spectrums? I did see some pretty bad ones this year.
I did see one bad one, but I'm pretty sure it's intentionally bad. Sharknado. Let me rephrase that. I watched like the first 45 minutes, and if they are trying to make it like purposely bad, like to get like laughs or something, then I hate it because whatever. Like that's just a cheap way to make a movie.
Right.
But if it was serious, then this is my greater fear, and that means that like we're just letting people make whatever movie they want. So it just gives me fear because it's like, what if I make it as a producer or director and I'm just making dog crap and people are still watching it? Does that mean I'm a good director or does that just mean that America's stupid? Because it's like they made another one. I don't know if you knew that, but they made a sequel.
No.
Yeah, it's on Netflix or it's coming out on Netflix, I think.
I have to do another podcast with Jacob Scrimetti and Daniel Cavanaugh. We episode 13, we were talking. I don't even know how we got started on this, but we were talking about shitty movies, and I made a reference to Sharknado of tornadoes and sharks flying around everywhere, and Jacob Scrimetti didn't know that was an actual real movie. Like, as we were talking about it, he thought we were just kidding around. And then from there, we like thought up another like a movie where, I can't remember, it was like a nuclear power plant gets caught in a tornado, so it was like called Nukenado. And then this guy, this redneck guy from like Kentucky or something, goes outside, and they're like, Rick, come inside. And he's like, I'm not scared of no weather. And then he gets caught up in the tornado, Nukenado, and then the radiation makes him a giant, and then it's becomes Ricknado, and then somehow like he dies, he falls into like a volcano, so then it became Volcano Nado. So we were like riffing on it for like a really long time.
Oh my God,
it was really funny actually. But yeah, didn't see it, saw the commercials. I could probably say
Tara Reid's in it, and she looks like she's been doing a lot of coke since her last movie. Like, she went from, like, 18 years old, and then now she's, like, 1,000. Like, she just looks old. Oh, man, I'm ripping on Tara Reid now.
She'll never know.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah.
What was this really bad movie that I saw the other day?
I did watch one film that I thought, I don't know if it's the best, but I think I liked it, but I think it was definitely good because it was an interesting new twist on movies, and that's what I told you I like about movies. This is The End. The James Franco movie was pretty much an all-star cast. Either it was all-stars or just cameos because it was about, like, celebrities.
Yeah.
So everybody plays themselves. And I thought it was interesting because I'm pretty sure it was written as where they all just have their own, like, a character that's not actually them, but it still was them. I mean, they're using their names because it was about them as celebrities. And but it seemed like James Franco's character was like a real character, where he was like homosexually sort of ambiguously in love with Seth Rogen. And it was pretty funny, just the ability to make fun of themselves on screen. And then it was like a dark comedy too, because it was about like the end of the world, and
yeah,
it was like really cool like graphics with like demons and stuff, you know. And it had, you know,
the
some
ending
of my favorite TV
intense.
Actors too, like yeah, Craig Robinson and Danny McBride.
Yeah,
two of my favorite.
Aziz
Ansari.
I love when he falls off and then Craig's like, Aziz, man, I tried to save him.
Yeah. And then who was it? Who's that? Michael Cera. Like, I don't know if he's like actually a cokehead or not, but I kind of like, you know, the idea of thinking that he could have been, you know.
Yeah, I love the scene where he's at the table and he slaps the girl's ass, and then the guy
Rihanna. That was Rihanna.
Oh, was that Rihanna?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the guy's like, "Hey, man." Michael Cera's like, "What, bro? I'm trying to play a game here."
He gets like brutally killed too.
Yes.
Anyway, this is the end, and then there's like a cool message at the end, you know, like just be good to people. Because I was expecting it to be religious, you know, because it definitely had that undertone, but it really didn't specify any specific religion. It was like, if you're good, you can come here, you know,
yeah,
to heaven. And I guess heaven's just like a big party with like people from the past. Like it looked like it was really crowded up there in heaven, you know, when they get there, it's just kind of like a rave going on. But yeah, it was definitely, in my opinion, that was probably the better movie of 2013.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah.
I also watched another comedy with Jennifer Aniston. What was the name? And Jason Sudeikis. What was the name of that? Meet not the Fockers or parents. It was Meet the somebody. Meet the Joneses or something. It was about
they
like
go on a road trip or something.
Yeah, they go on like a road trip. He's like, they're not really his family.
Yeah, Jennifer Aniston's a stripper.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. The kids like just the two kids are just miscreants.
And I think the writers were the same for people from Little Miss Sunshine or something like that.
Oh, that was an independent film from a while back, so that'd be interesting to know.
Yeah,
I should look that up.
I didn't know that was an independent film.
Yeah,
oh,
well, you know, a lot of movies are independent that you see. Mm. Like The Sixth Sense was actually an independent. M. Night Shyamalan was another one that won the Sundance, and they made him into an actual director.
He is someone that I really like. He's kind of fallen off. Yeah.
But he definitely changed the way people do cinema. And again, that's what I appreciate.
He's also one of those people you either love or hate his movies in a way. I think The Sixth Sense was really good. Signs is probably one of my favorite movies.
It was The Village where I was like,
dude,
I'm done.
A lot of people say that. I love The Village.
I didn't like it too much.
Yeah.
I think it was because with me, and I think most people, they wanted it to be aliens or something, you know? And it really wasn't. It was just like a big conspiracy.
Yeah.
So, spoiler alert, I guess that was...
Well, you didn't actually spoil or anything, but I know what you're talking about. But no, I mean, I was thinking about that movie the other night, and Joaquin Phoenix and the blind girl, and the monsters are pretty scary. I mean, and when the whole the movie's building up and they're just doing their regular stuff, and they're making these sacrifices to the things in the woods, and they're not supposed to go in the woods, and they're sitting down to like these pilgrim Thanksgiving dinners, and you're not really sure what's going on or what they're doing here or who's oppressing
them. It doesn't seem
them.
Like it's actually America.
No. It seems like, I don't know. I mean, it's so blocked in. You feel like a child yourself, you know, because as the viewer, not knowing anything of what's going on, it's very... You know, it drew me in, and then the dogs start dying, and the chickens are being hung by the doors, and then the things start coming out and start marking the doors or whatever, and they start coming around, and he has a lot of religious undertones in his movies, and I mean, the monsters are just creepy, and
even
then
though they're like manufactured.
And then towards the end, where not to ruin anything or whatever, but like the girl goes into the forest, and then one of them starts coming after her, and then it's like, damn, what really is going on? And then I won't say any more about it then, but I don't know, it's pretty interesting. But yeah, that's his Village is one that just people are real torn. I hear more people say they don't like it than they do.
Yeah.
But I think for me, it was just that first time watching, the way it felt after the first time watching, that gave me the, you know, because after that, you know, you're kind of, anytime you rewatch it, it's got some people might say it doesn't have as much replay value because now you know and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I still thought it was pretty good. I never saw... he did Lady in the Water, too, which was
pretty... I didn't really watch that one. But see, I kind of should have because it's got Paul Giamatti, and I really like that guy. I really like Giamatti.
Yeah. I don't remember who that is. Is he the main actor? Or?
Yeah, the bearded guy. A little short, bald guy.
Okay.
Mm. Isn't he in it? I thought he was.
He may be.
Maybe he's not bearded. He has different hair like every movie he's in.
Yeah. Yeah, that one has a lot of religious undertones, actually. And it would probably be worth re-watching that one, but it's just... Cause I don't remember much about it, but I remember watching it and just thinking, like, eh, it was all right. I never saw... Is This Happening or This Is Happening? So, what is it? The Happening. That's what it is. Yeah. You know, with the bees and all that. That just seemed kind of weird. But I remember that one also didn't do very well. And so I don't know. Oh, and then this... I think there was another one he did like kind of recently. I don't know. I'm not sure what it was. I think he did... Did he do Unbreakable or something with... Bruce Willis, was that
I don't him? Know if that was him, because I think that was before The Sixth Sense. That was a good movie, though. I did like that.
Yeah.
Definitely like a different take on a superhero movie. Definitely dark.
Yeah. Anywho, I hope he gets it together, because he does, you know, I think he's got some stuff going.
Yeah.
If he could just get it together a little more.
From what I hear, a lot of people just start losing creativity after a while.
Yeah.
It's like a thing that you have, and you use too much of it. Yeah. Matt Stone and Trey Parker of South Park have been saying that. You know, they've just been lately running out of ideas. I don't know if you knew this, but Bill Hader now writes for the show.
Bill Hader?
Yeah. Who's that? He used to be in SNL. He was, you've seen Superbad? Mm-hmm. The black-haired cop.
Okay.
That guy.
Oh, okay.
He writes for their show now.
Yeah.
They've just been, according to them, they've just been running out of ideas, you know?
Yeah.
I think their height was like season like 12 through 15.
Right.
Those are like really their best seasons, I think.
Well, I mean, The Simpsons are still going.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Groening. But I think what ends up happening is you either change your idea or change the show, and then you have more ideas. Like South Park used to be very character based.
Mm-hmm.
They ran out of ideas there, and then moved to more like current events and political ideas.
Mm-hmm. Bless you.
Sorry. So I think maybe either they're gonna have to change it again, but still be able to keep it interesting, or you know, just keep hiring more writers to write for the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like Bill Hader.
Yeah. I remember glancing over an article about how Matt Groening from The Simpsons creator has a team of mathematicians that write the episodes.
Yeah.
And
I've heard that that's Stephen Hawking's favorite show.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
He likes The Simpsons. They have him featured on there a lot, too.
Yeah. That's a classic show. I haven't watched it really in years, but... Simpsons are pretty awesome, though. This is from Vulture.com, and it's the list of the 2013's worst movies. They have Labor Day, which I don't know what that is. Only God Forgives. Machete Kills. I saw that in Blockbuster, but rest in peace, Blockbuster. Salinger. Don't know what that is. Speaking of James Franco, The Oz Great and Powerful. Also, it was supposed to be, like, one of the worst.
It was all right. I wasn't too thrilled on it. I mean, I guess it had a lot of cool effects, whatever. It wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen, though. I think, the one other movie that I saw this year that was awful, and I don't even know if it was 2013. I think it was. But that Spring Break with James Franco, it was terrible. Have you heard of it or seen it?
Mm-mm.
James Franco plays a basically a drug dealer in Florida, and he's just like an idiot, like a big hick, but like he's kind of wealthy. He is wealthy because he's like a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And he meets Selena Gomez is in it for a little bit, and then she ends up leaving. But these three like 17-year-old girls go down to Florida for spring break, meet this rapper James Franco who's like got cornrows in his hair. The guy ends up, spoiler alert, James Franco dies, and then they, like, the three girls, they basically fell in love with him, and they're all, like, missing him and stuff. I didn't really get where the plot went with it. It, like, wasn't realistic, and there were several scenes where they kept repeating stuff. There's a scene where him and the three girls were, I guess, having sex, and they'd all keep repeating the word, spring break. For, like, I swear, 20 minutes, the movie was this. Spring Break. Spring Break. With, like, trance music in the background. And then, like, weird faded in and out shots of, like, all four of the people in the bed. Spring Break. It just kept going on, and it was like, oh, my God. It was awful.
Turned into a zombie movie, it sounds like, for a couple minutes.
Well, James Franco, like, changed his voice to sound like a hick rapper. I don't know. It was weird. Yeah, I just didn't like it. I could see what it was James Franco was trying to, like, see his creativity and to see how drastically he could, like, be a different character.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it worked.
Did any of you actually see Only God Forgives?
No.
That we just named that one. It's
yeah,
on the...
I heard you. That's why I joined in.
Yeah.
So you guys haven't
no,
seen
it? No, I've never heard of it.
You guys need to see that movie.
Are you sure?
Yes.
An Upside Down Opposite Land, the reunion of Drive
know,
director Nicholas Winding and
oh,
star
Gucci
Ryan
Man
Gosling
is
in an entrancing revenge drama, hallucinatory in its palette, Kublonky in its pacing. Kubonky in its pacing. In this world, it's one of the stupidest movies we've ever made.
It is. And at the end, it will enrage you. But that's what I loved about it. It, like, brought forth so much emotion. Not, like, gripping, passionate emotion, like, oh, it was such a good movie. It was just like, what the fuck? No! No!
Well, it got a reaction out of you.
Yeah.
Like, what? I mean,
and that, isn't that the point of art, though?
Yeah, I mean, if it got a reaction, as long as it
was
wasn't
terrible.
About the producers itself.
I mean...
I just couldn't believe how, like... How I reacted at the end.
Well, that was what was, you know, that was what the auteur renaissance,
like,
was all about.
How dare you? How dare you?
Between,
I don't even know who directed it, but.
But the auteur renaissance, like the period in film between 1967 and 1970, roughly six, it was all about, like, shocking the audience. You know, Harold and Maude was written in that time, and that was about an 80-year-old woman and an 18-year-old man falling in love.
I never saw that
and
one.
And people
either.
Don't, like, people watch it and were like, ooh, it makes me feel uncomfortable, but it. And people, I think a lot of people saw him like, this is stupid, but I think it was so good because it shocked so many people. And that was when Deep Throat came out. It was a porn with Linda Lovelace. But it was the first... it's kind of what made people realize, hey, we don't really want this kind of stuff being shown in theaters. Because it was an X-rated movie. Even though there's definitely a Deep Throat scene in it.
Europe shows nudity on the TV.
You know, that's the difference between American cinema and European cinema is that in Europe, they don't really care so much about sex, like, censorship. They care about, like, violence censorship. And in America, we care more about, like, censoring sex than violence, which I think should be the other way around. Like a naked body or a naked man or a naked woman, that's, like, a natural thing. But
yeah,
you know, violence is, like, something much worse and dark and sinister.
Well... That kind of points to where...
Which I don't think anything should be censored.
What kind of Hollywood we do have, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're all about the violence, but...
Well, it's all about the MPAA.
Show a naked dude, and it's, oh, God.
Did you know that the Movie Picture, or Motion Picture Association, like the people that rate films, they actually, and they did there's a documentary on this called This Film Is Not Yet Rated on Netflix.
Yeah, you talked about it a little bit on the last podcast.
I still haven't seen that one.
Yeah, okay, yeah. There's two clergymen that are required to be on that board, on the appeals board. And then they're like, they're all kept secret. All the raiders and those two are like kept secret. So.
Interesting.
Just, that's what's rating what we get to see, you know?
Other than what I'm seeing on the list, I wanted to come back to this. Saving Mr. Banks is apparently not that great. It's also on this list of top.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. Which is weird because it looked like it would have been a winner, but what do I know? Carrie supposedly didn't do so great.
Oh, I've heard that it did pretty bad, but they've already made a Carrie.
I didn't see it, and I don't know why they made another one.
I don't either. The first one was fine.
I
mean,
for
it being like an old
movie.
I don't know
why they're doing so many remakes of all these classic badass movies. It was like, oh, that was great. It was so good. Let's make it again.
Well, let's look
at the...
They want
to milk the money cow.
Let's look at who wrote all
that,
though.
Get the blood out the pig in this...
That was Stephen King's first published book.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like every horror movie they make with him that he writes, or like the book for, it's like different. Like he doesn't stick to the same thing. There was the Carrie, and then there's like The Shining, and then there's The Stand, and then there's Salem's Lot, and all of them are like different themes and different things. I mean, when you read the books, you can still see like tell that it's the same writer, but and the movies pretty much follow the storylines, and they're always pretty different.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I just thought that was an interesting... The fact that he's never really had to like worry about writer's block. He's always been able to write, and people just buy it all up, and it's still good. I've, you know, read all the Dark Tower series.
Yeah, I'm on book like three or four.
There's a new one out apparently that's supposed to be between 4 and 5 that I haven't read, because it just came out like a few years ago.
Yeah, he really set up an interesting thing. I still don't know what the hell's going on, really, but
I don't want to spoil that for you.
Yeah, please
don't. Good. There's just so much in that whole series of books.
I've heard Dark Tower is really good.
Yeah.
That's probably what I need to pick up. I haven't picked up a book because I haven't been knowing what to read in a long while. I have Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Repair, and that's been pretty good.
Yeah.
But I just kind of stopped reading it for a while, and now I'm feeling like I need to fill a gap. So maybe that's what I'll do. Maybe I'll pick up the next Dark Tower book.
Actually, they've been talking about doing a Gunslinger movie, and they were thinking about playing Hugh Jackman as Roland, and I didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
I mean,
it could work.
Not that Hugh Jackman's bad, but I don't, like, I know the character Roland, and that doesn't, like, I mean, Clint Eastwood is the one that should play him, but he's not young enough anymore.
Yeah. That's exactly who I was thinking just now.
Yeah. I think that's who Stephen King had in mind when he was developing that character.
We should pick one of the actors from this top 10 worst. How about James Franco? He could be Roland. How about Ryan Gosling?
Ryan Gosling. He's too pretty. Maybe Eddie.
How about
Eddie.
Seth Rogen?
Seth Rogen. I kind of want Rogen. That. I want that. I want to see this done.
He'd just be like, oh,
just a
the
fat
whole time.
Shit turd. That's what he is.
Some curly-headed fuck.
You know what else was really bad now that I think about it? Elysium. Did y'all see Elysium with Matt Damon?
I've heard of it.
No,
it's more like Elysium Dumb. It was bad.
It sounded like it would be cool, the concept.
Yeah. I mean, I think it came from the same dudes who did District 9. District 9 was a good movie. And it was the same kind of...
I have that movie and I haven't seen it. Can you believe that?
My ex-wife, no. Oh my gosh.
Fix that now.
Well, when me and my ex-wife were going through the problems, this was like years ago, we were going through problems. She watched that movie and was like, oh my God, that couple is like me and you. I'm like, I turned into an alien and like deserted you? Like, what does that even mean? Like, wow. Like, I turned into a new creature and then... But she like, it wasn't like, she was like trying to say that it was like a good thing. Like, no, it's like sweet. It's like us. I'm like... No, it's not. Your people.
Pus just exploded out of his head. What are you talking about? Apparently, the Lone Ranger did really bad too, and Olympus Has Fallen.
I don't. Yeah, I kept hearing my friends say that
the
Olympus
Lone
Has
Ranger
Fallen
was
and,
not that good.
Yeah,
I saw it.
I think it's. It bore well, the wasn't shit another out of like? I don't. I just, I'm starting to not like any of the stuff that major studios put out.
Yeah,
it's just crap, and they don't really have any creative writers. They just keep doing the same old thing. And I feel like that's probably, I haven't seen it, but I'm pretty sure it looked like one of those movies where it, same Hollywood like plot setup. It's been done for 70 years. They just haven't changed anything.
Yep.
Guess who gets the girl?
Johnny Depp?
No. Or the other Lone guy? Ranger, duh. Johnny Depp's just some weird guy and he's okay with it. Like always.
Like always. I bet you could look up his filmography. And he has been in some crazy stuff, like some just weird, obscure movies.
Who?
Oh, yeah.
Johnny Depp.
I've seen a couple, like, on the internet and in stores that I haven't seen. I'm like, oh, what is this movie?
Yeah.
Never heard of this, but it looks weird.
There's, like, one really old black and white movie, and it's, like, a Western. I don't know what it's called.
It's
Deadwood or something? No. Is that
a
TV
series?
A
show.
Okay.
I've seen several Westerns. You know, Star Wars is considered a Western.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
It's because of the way that the plot set. It's considered a science fiction Western, like a hybrid book. That's why it was the first of its kind, because science fiction up until that point were things like Flash Gordon, I think, was considered not the first. The first science fiction movie ever considered was Trip to the Moon by Georges Méliès, and that was like the silent film era.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually kind of funny if you watch it. It's only like 10 minutes long. But anyway, I think the first like in modern cinema was Flash Gordon, and it was still, they made it to where it was really mysterious and like weird. And then Star Wars came and took that away. It became, because even Star Trek, which was a show that came up between that, the first series had like the creepy music in the beginning, and it was all about discovering the new weird and unknown worlds, which isn't a bad plot. But Star Wars came out, and it was a science fiction Western because it was in an alien, you know, galaxy. but it was like the music was like orchestrated like a Western was, you know, like people, like villains had theme music, you know, it was all about like an outlaw, like renegade, basically tribe, like the rebels fighting off like the bad sheriff in town being like the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why, that was one of the reasons why it was so different and new and people liked it, was because it was just a new kind of plot.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Star Wars, because last night I had a dream, and at the very end of this dream, I was at like a Star Wars convention or something like that, and George Lucas was like there or something, and all of a sudden in my head, I don't know how it came to be, but all of a sudden I was like, someone needs to make a video game or a movie about a Jedi Knight who's like a stealth assassin. Who just has like a weird lightsaber thing where he just like, he's like a ninja. He's like a ninja Jedi or something like that. Like it's all stealth based gameplay. I think I envisioned it as a game, like a video game that was being played at the convention or something like that. And he just, I'm trying to think of like stealth video games that are really popular.
Tenchu Stealth Assassins.
Like a Splinter Cell.
Yeah. Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, like an Assassin's Creed, like, because he uses the Force, so he gets to do like a whole bunch of crazy, like running and jumping and all this stuff.
That's cool, man.
But, and I'm sure in the Star Wars universe, like the books or something, they've created this kind of person. But they need to make like a game where you can actually play it and do that kind of thing. And at the end of the dream, once I like visualized the game, I was running around looking for George Lucas, like, I'm going to be rich. I just got to find George Lucas and tell him. And then my alarm went off and I was like, no, I was like, I got to go do a podcast. And I was about to make so much money talking to George Lucas. But, and then it was funny because I was getting ready to get all the gear and stuff together for this. And I told myself, like, I was in the bathroom. I told myself, I was like, before I leave the house, I've got to like write down that concept, just to write it down, just to have it. And so I'm glad you brought it up, because I just completely forgot about it. Probably never would have remembered it. So now it's on the internet forever. So yay. I'll remember it like this.
I think the best, I remember the best like assassin game I ever played was that Tenchu game for the first PlayStation. I don't know if you remember. It was kind of an obscure game, but we had it and it was really fun.
It was for a PlayStation.
I remember it.
Tenchu.
There was like two or three of them also, but it was really hard. And I always like difficulty in video games because it gives you something to work at. But it was basically you just pick either the girl or the boy ninja.
Mm-hmm.
And in each mission you get to pick like, in every one you get more. Like you get to pick like items. Like you can bring shurikens or like health things or like these poison rice bags to feed to people or decoys. Like you get to pick more stuff. But it's difficult because you have to save some of it so that you can get like more for a different mission later. And it's like there's like a weird currency you get. But there's like 12 missions and you basically go around and like you have to kill everybody, but they make it the fighting kind of realistic for its time because you don't really want to fight anybody. So like somebody could kill you with like one hit, you know, or you can kill them with one hit, but you got to do like a stealth attack. And there's like different like types of stealth attacks, and the way it's set up is like there's basically sentries all over the levels, and like some of them are stationary, some of them are on roofs, and they all have like the AI is basically like they'll turn for certain moments and turn this way, and you gotta like sneak up on them, and then some of them walk, some of them are like jumping around, so you gotta just figure out different ways to like kill this one, but like not let this one see you, because then it gets to where like there's like four of them in an open field, and you gotta like figure out how to like systematically hit all of them before the like last one sees you.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really difficult, but it was definitely like I would play it again, even though it's like an older game.
PlayStation 1, you said?
Yeah. Mm. I think they made one for PS2. I never played any of the sequels though.
Mm.
So, and I'm pretty sure like a lot of games, the sequels started getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I wonder what other good like best and worst of this year. Probably just the best. I wouldn't want to focus on the worst, but playing Papers, Please right now, which is pretty interesting. It's just an independent PC game, and it's just you're an immigration officer, and you just people walk in, they hand you paperwork, and then you have to find discrepancies in their paperwork and what they say they're going to do. And it's really low res. It looks like an NES game or like the oldest kind of computer game you could play. Super simple, and you just have to figure out what doesn't match up, and then based on that, you can confirm or deny their entry to the country. And as you're at the end of the day, you have a family, you have to feed, give medicine, provide heat, you got to pay rent, and you make like no money because you work for a communist country. and your boss is always over your note, and every day you have more things that you have to do. You have to either scan them, fingerprint them, detain them. Some people will try to bribe you. Some people bring bombs and will try to kill soldiers on the other line. And but you're just fixed in this one cubicle, and it's like all you do, and it's like super mundane, but strangely fun. And I was working yesterday, and then at the end of the day, I could not wait to get home and just reject people from getting into the country. But that, and then Slender Man was another really cool game, also another independent film. And I've been meaning to talk about it a little bit on the podcast. I've never got around to it, but I've been wanting to hype it up just because it is such an interesting game. It would be awesome if more people supported it so that they actually make it a real game. Because the original one came out a year or two ago, and it was just one dude who just made it. And then they've got a really small studio, and they made it into a small independent film that they charge $5 or $10, and it's six levels.
I want to see it on the Wii U. You can move that thing.
Is it
around.
On there?
I want to see it on there. Because you can actually move around and then, see Slender Man or Slender.
Yeah. Yeah. And what this game is basically you just walk around in the forest and you've got to collect items. And the more items you collect, the more Slender Man pursues you. And there's this, ominous music that kicks in and builds up the more notes you collect.
And it gets staticky too.
Yeah, it gets staticky, and you die based on your proximity to Slender Man and how close or how much you look at him. Mm-hmm. So, and you have a flashlight that dies, and that's all you have. You're just running around with a flashlight trying to collect random. Every time you play the level, they kind of generate in different places, and Slender Man also generates completely random. He could be anywhere. He just kind of pops up. And it's pretty scary game, actually. It's real hard to play by yourself, but it's super fun to watch other people play. There's tons of reaction videos of people online playing it, mm-hmm. and just, basically scaring the bejesus out of each other and just playing this game. And Slender Man is just a really tall, he's a 7-foot thing in a business suit with no face. And if you look at his face, that's what kills you. So you have to constantly run away from him, but you can get tired, and like I said, your flashlight will die, so pretty interesting game.
Yeah, there's not really much of a story, it's just kind of there,
Yeah, which is what I'm hoping.
Mystery is what gives it its power.
Yeah, but it's based off of one of the original internet horror figures. I don't know the full story, but there's all these pictures online of these kids playing. And in the background, you see this weird figure that has dozens of arms extending out of its back. And there's just these stories about these kids go to play and they just disappear or something like that. The Slender Man takes them. So it's a really interesting game. Pretty scary, though. But I'd still highly recommend it.
Another game that is an older game, but it was for Xbox, 360, called Alan Wake. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I think I played it a little bit, maybe for an hour.
It was a new kind of game that I really liked, and because it had it was a cool story, but it was more like playing a really interesting detective movie,
mm-hmm.
but with a supernatural twist. And then they had this band that they called Old Gods of Asgard that they got to do the music for, and it was because the music is actually an integral part of the plot. Because you find out that these idiots basically got this, they were rock musicians in the 80s and they became washed up, but you find out that their music in the 80s, their hit songs were actually these premonitions that they would have. And then you find out that the premonitions were about the character's story, Alan Wake. Mm-hmm. And it's basically the lyrics tell you in the game, what you're supposed to do, find the lady in the light. You have to they give you all these weird little hints that you have to do.
Yeah.
To get past the game.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. The gameplay was interesting, but it was a little bit repetitive. And I kind of get bored with that. Kind of when the first Assassin's Creed came out. It was cool at first, but then you kill people the same way in each town. And you got to do the same stuff every time. Mm-hmm. Kind of annoying after a while.
Yeah, they just released Black Flag. Assassin's Creed Black Flag. And that's more open ocean, pirate exploration, yeah. treasure hunting, sea shanties, and all manner of that kind of thing. Sounds pretty interesting. But And then I was talking to a friend about The Sims a couple days ago. I used to play the original Sims. It was like in elementary school or something like that. Whenever it came out, it was pretty interesting. I mean, that was one of the first games you got to play God, you know, yeah. really tweak things and all that kind of stuff.
I like, in that generation of games, I liked the Roller Coaster Tycoon series.
Yeah, me too.
Those are fun.
Yeah.
The third one got, like, not only too easy, but it was, like, just ridiculous. Like, so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
First one was fun, because it was more of a business that you had to run. And
yeah.
It was definitely kind of, like, difficult, you know. You couldn't just make the most ridiculous roller coaster, because people would be too freaked out by it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a shame, because that's what I really enjoy doing. Yeah. Or, you know, those things that shoot straight up. I would make them super tiny and then make their speed, like, full blast. No, it would just, like, shoot off the rails.
Uh-oh.
I don't know how that was possible to allow that. But I think you had to gauge the pressure that it shot up with the amount, how high it went. So I'd make it super low and go as high as possible. So they would just shoot off into space and then come down and blow up. It was kind of mean, but you could also do that with the one, like those roller coasters that shoot up, they do a loop, and then they go all the way up, they stop at the top, and then they go backwards, they do the loop again, and then they come. I would make those super short and super fast, and they go and
fly off. You could pick people up, too.
Yeah.
I used to, when I would see people litter in my park, I would pick them up and put them in a little lake of water.
Yeah.
And they would die.
Yep.
That's what happens when you litter in my park.
Yep, die. I remember those days. Just pick them up with the little claw.
Yeah.
Throw them somewhere.
And then your rating goes down, but that's okay. It teaches them a lesson. That way they learn. Then you don't have to, you make it up by not having to hire more janitors to clean out the sidewalks.
Exactly. If I didn't want my park ratings to go down with people dying, then I would just make a little square patch where it was just tons of panda bears just running around, or tigers, or one of those mascots, and then I just put them in that little patch.
So it's like a little fun concentration camp. Yeah, I like that idea.
It seemed fun for the first hour,
but then
when they were like, shit, I can't get out of here. I don't know what to do. Because they could only walk, I think, where there was pavement. Oh, so
man, that sounds like a mushroom trip, just being fenced in with a bunch of like pandas.
And everyone else is having fun on the roller coasters and all the other rides over there, but I can't figure out quite how to get to
these
that.
Fucking pandas.
Good times on those games. All right, man, I'm going to wrap it up. It's almost party time.
Yeah.
It's 3:30.
Yeah.
We're going to bring in the New Year's. What are you going to do? You got any plans?
Yeah, I think we're all just going to go visit Brittany while she's at work in Manhattan tonight.
Oh, word. Yeah. Okay. Very nice. Well, here's 2014. Better times ahead, right?
Yep.
Steady times, good rolling.
I'm the law.
Dun, dun, dun. That's all. Coastal Noise Podcast. .com. That's not the website. I just messed that up. CoastalNoise.com. You can go to the podcast page. There's all the other stuff. So get it, got it good. All right, bye.